This episode of The Drunken Odyssey is brought to you by Scribophile, an online community with thousands of serious writers working in every conceivable genre. If you're eager to improve your own work and network with others, Scribophile is for you. Scribophile has educational tutorials, exciting forums, and most importantly, the ability to exchange in-depth critiques with other writers, using a karma system that keeps the exchange fair and equal. What is most exciting to me is that Scribophile allows writers to critique novel chapters, which is not something a writer can be guaranteed to experience in an MFA program. A basic account is free and grants you all the features, but upgrading to a premium account allows you to gain access to posting numerous works at once, requires no additional karma points to enter contests and other special features for only $9 a month or $65 a year. That's a lot less than a Netflix subscription. Listeners of The Drunken Odyssey will receive a 20% discount on top of those already low rates. Check out this week's show notes for details.
Dear Cerebral Angiogram, I love you, Rainbow. I send mountaintop and strum. I send three cords and a femoral artery. I send my Sasquatch bearing inks of plenty. I drop flowers before your long way of looking at me, of making trains stretch for syllables. I lift this ode to your northern compass, your colors, your branching out, your streaks and steadies, your way of rounding into view, the way you Missouri my Mississippi, muddy the bend, flood my plain way of being with dye to light me up. I send carotid artery and a list of problems. Fistula, anomaly. I ask that you open lines of dialogue. I find the clot you leave under the bruise. I ask that you open lines of time. I bend a knee to your reach, your perfect nose. Flower pot, I love your crazy hair.
Welcome to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life.
Tell us, oh muse, about a man whose mind and career has careened far and wide and upside down, whose computers are seared with crimes against grammar, whose typographical aggressions are legion, whose words flow into the very mouth of time, and more than a few bottles. A man who actually owns a typewriter, and perhaps even a soul.
And now, your host, John King.
Welcome, my friends, to episode 437 of the world's greatest writing podcast. Probably. On this week's show, I talked to the poet Steve Davenport. I first spoke with Steve back in February of 2013, which feels like several lifetimes ago. Life is kicking my ass so hard right now. Normally, this show drops on Saturday mornings, or if things get bumpy, Saturday afternoon. Last week's show came out on Monday. Partly that happened because I refused to lose my shit, and I wanted to eulogize my dear friend Blake and put my thoughts together about authoritarian thought loops and cognitive dissonance and why trying to persuade the people of Trumpistan is like trying to chop the heads off the Hydra. It makes a mess and doesn't really accomplish anything good. Fox pundit Greg Gutfeld went on a rant this week about how if Biden is elected, that Biden supporters will commit a bloodletting of the right and Fox pundits like himself, like a literal bloodletting. So, one, Biden supporters are mostly Democrats and liberals who will likely be holding their noses as they cast a ballot against fascism. So I don't know how high energy we are around him in particular, and two, we are now supposed to be responsible for how Greg Gutfeld feels when he imagines how much hate we feel for him, completely independent of any and all facts. He does know we don't watch Fox News, right? Like, we mostly don't know who he is. Oh, and Ace Frehley is an asshole who supports Trump because he, Ace Frehley, looked at the evidence and decided that Trump is our strongest possible leader now. I can only hope his vantage point from outer space is cause for this distortion. I really need to stop letting Rolling Stone's reportage into my inbox, everybody. So I like to open up the show by reporting and opining on literary news. Do my political observations count? What do you think? I don't want to seem like Nero here. Though maybe Laura Nero. Okay, so I hereby repudiate the Collisions, my Ace Frehley-Benny Hill mashup fanfiction, though I still support Benny Hill and David Foster Wallace's appearance in that story, problematic as those two figures might be. I've been reading Chuck Palahniuk lately, and I continue to be of the opinion that he started as a great writer, and that he keeps getting better. His recent book on writing, Consider This, and his brand new novel, The Invention of Sound, are pretty fucking great. Sometimes when I awake in the morning, late morning, I do nothing but swear as the pain travels along my old CNS and I creep around like a giant stop-motion puppet out of bed and into the kitchen for some caffeine and medicine. But sometimes I wake up with actual sentences running through my head. And earlier this week, I wrote them down, which feels even better than not being in pain. More of that, please. I also came up with a new revision strategy. My latest short story feels stilted at times, like the dirt and aggression and electricity of life isn't in it. Or not enough, anyway. So I revised it while listening to Aerosmith play the blues really loud in my headphones. Like, really loud. And trusted my instincts to feel the quivers in some more human language, letting more surprises happen. This is probably how I also do my best writing. Well, not necessarily Aerosmith's blues album, which is okay, but not the best blues album or the best Aerosmith album. That would be Toys in the Attic, and yes, I know, that seems really basic. But any music that helps shake the dust off my brain will work. I'd like to give a shout out in this introduction to my friend Bethany Duvall, whose kind ear and sage advice restored my faith in humankind this week, or at least for a half an hour. And sometimes that's all the difference you need in the world. It was really great to speak with Steve again. He seems like someone I should have been friends with decades ago. Sometimes during my interviews, a lot of times, I'm not asking enough proper questions, and I'm instead sharing notes about what it means to be human with smart people who are like me, except better or smarter or both. Steve is like that.
And now, the interview of the day.
My guest today is the poet Steve Davenport, whose latest book is called Bruise Songs, which is this extended, wonderful meditation on how to construct meaning in a self that is maybe coming apart, although arguably, if we're paying attention, that's all of us kind of all of the time. And, you know, this collection of poems seem to speak to one another. They're clearly part of an organized group. And it seems like this was a book of poems that imposed itself upon you since you had anticipated that you'd be writing fiction. So, Steve, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, John. I can say that probably when last time I talked to you, and it was true after actually my first book, I swore I would never write another collection of poems. And then when you interviewed me, I'm sure I said the same thing, if not to you, to everyone else. So I had no, you know, I was going to write fiction, that, and I was writing fiction, but a poem here and there happened, you know, after I had the stroke, just as, for instance, the poem I read at the opening of the show, that was a poem I wrote just as a sort of test to see if I could recover language that I had lost during a stroke. So I wrote that one, and then I wrote, you know, another one. I happened to be up in Chicago at AWP, and I was sitting next to, and I did not know, the editor of, at the time, an important lit mag up in Kansas City. By the way, speaking of, we were speaking earlier of senior moments off camera. One of them is that I'll forget the titles of every magazine I can think of. But New Letters. New Letters was a magazine. So I'm sitting there with Robert Stewart, not knowing it's Robert Stewart. I'm sitting with a couple of novelist friends, Thomas E. Kennedy and Duff Brenna. And what I don't know is that one of them or both of them has been talking me up to Robert Stewart. And again, I don't know it's Robert Stewart. I don't know we're talking about New Letters. And it turns out that Robert Stewart had brought one of my poems from Overpass or Uncontainable Noise, I can't remember, to his class. And they were talking about my titles and the titles of my poems. And Thomas E. Kennedy was about to use the title of one of those poems for a collection of short pieces of his own. And it was because of that moment when all of a sudden it occurred to me, I was sitting with Robert Stewart and there was an opportunity, since he professed that he liked a particular poem of mine and the titles he had been shown, that I sent him a few poems. And I was going to send him a few poems, which meant right after AWP, I ran home and wrote some poems and sent them to him. And he published them. And it just went like that. You know, I was not going to write another collection of poems. I didn't want the pressure of trying to find a publisher, trying to find an audience. It's not that I didn't ever want to talk to you again. I certainly enjoy that.
We could talk about any kind of writing, so.
You know, but I just did not have any plan. And so things came very slowly. And I have to say, in my mind, this book is not as intentional a collection of poems as the first two collections were. But at the end, when I found a publisher, a story I'm sure we'll come to in a little bit or later, I looked at the poems I had and began moving them around and realized there were thematic connections and musical connections I could build on. And so I wrote a few more, and I ended up with this very thin collection. Thin in terms of, I hope, not quality, but quantity. And so, yes, I wanted it also, though, to be a collection of poems that could be read in any order and that did not have, you know, they did not have to all be connected in some way. But I think most collections of poetry these days are, you know, musically or thematically collections that need to be read in the order in which they're published or organized. And I guess my collections maybe no different. But
well, to people who have streamed this podcast without looking at the Drunken Odyssey's page for this episode, Bruce Songs, right? Bruce Songs is a near rhyme for blues songs. And on the cover is the carcass of a saxophone. Without
yes,
all the valves that it necessarily would need to play like a saxophone. And, you know, that fits really, even though most blues outfits don't have a sax, but although maybe Bruce outfits do have saxophones, but it really fits the theme of this collection, which is, you know, like to go back to Frost a little bit, you know, what to make of a diminished thing. And it's not necessarily that it's absolutely diminished other than a sense of mortality and, you know, the onset of silence, which is, you know, waiting for us all. I wonder when I die if my tinnitus will finally stop or if whatever happens next, there'll still be this little microscopic screaming happening in some sort of free-floating consciousness that...
Well, you know, I'm going to interject about this cover so I don't forget to say this. When I found out that this collection was going to be published... I knew I wanted to call it Blues Songs. It did not occur to me that it rhymed with blues songs until you just said so. Although maybe it's just that I don't remember that it rhymed with blues songs, but I needed a cover, and I spent a lot of time looking at images online because I knew that more people would look at the cover than would read the poems inside. And so I just thought, I want to win that battle. And I found all sorts of images that I thought were brilliant, although I couldn't use them because they were just images I found online. And then I talked to a couple of writer friends. And the first candidate was a friend of mine you've talked to before, Lillian Bertram, with whom I write a couple of poems in the collection. Mm-hmm. She had a friend that happened to be out in the woods walking in whatever state he lived in, and there was the carcass of a piano just in the middle of the woods. And it was beautifully decayed. And he sent her a picture, and she sent it to me, and I thought that was going to be the cover. Until I remembered that I had another writer friend, a documentarian, Joe Johnston, who worked repairing instruments, musical instruments. And I asked him, and I knew that he had all sorts of broken down, sort of a mausoleum of instruments, because I'd seen references to them or photos. And so he went down and found a few instruments, one of which was this saxophone, all damaged and bent, and sent it to me. And I don't really know enough about music to know what instruments are in what bands. I just knew that when I saw that beat up old saxophone, it spoke to mortality, it spoke to music, it spoke to my aging body and the damage in the collection and in my body and all of that. And I thought it was beautiful. Now, I wouldn't know what's missing from that musical instrument because I don't play one and I don't know much. I just know that I thought at first, okay, this might be corny, a saxophone by itself on a cover, but everybody I showed it to said, no, that's good, that's good. And I handed it over to Stephen F. Austin Press, and they did what they did.
Well, the difference between the perfect image and the tacky, predictable image is sometimes very slender.
Yes, it is.
And, you know, this is I think it's an advanced lesson for literary writers is sometimes to be honest about our emotions, we do have to risk sentiment. Like, it's bad to be sentimental and go, I'm going to make people cry because we care about the same things and I can touch these, but like all of that. And we go so far in the other direction. Right. Because we're terrified that we will be seen as hack writers or something that, you know, we worry over much, I think, about avoiding sentiment and then end up being too fussy or formal, you know.
Or ironic or I listened to the interview your friend, and I hope I pronounce his name right, Jamie Poisant,
yeah,
did with you about Guy Psycho. And I wanted to high five him when he talked about sincerity in music and, you know, sometimes music just needs to, you know, be sincere. And I know that I maybe it's the old man in me, but I will, you know, I've been as ironic as every other hipster I know, but as I've gotten older, I've missed sincerity. Now, often it's cheesy. I listen to some of my old 70s music where there's greater sincerity, I think, than there is in a lot of 80s music, but sometimes there's too much cheese, but I'm reminded of Richard Hugo, and he said, you know, a great art must contain a certain amount of cheese, you know, but it's weighing and picking that cheese that's exceedingly difficult.
And sometimes it's just in the voice. I visited my mother in the Villages, you know, ground zero for Fox viewership. And, you know, we're an Irish family. And so for St. Patrick's Day, we went to visit Mom up in the Villages, and we went to the grounds. This was years ago before COVID. You know, there are several sort of centralized downtown areas where people actually do congregate like they're an old time village. And there are hired talent who are performing, you know, Oh Danny Boy. And it's like, oh God, like, let me plug up my ears and get a drink until this is over. And Harry Connick performed it in a way that it's like, oh no, this is a great song. I just hate its cultural role.
as this standard that people are just going to flog. And one of the things Harry Connick did to really make it surprising is it takes a long time for him to start singing. And it's just this very lush orchestral score leading us into Oh Danny Boy. And then I'm not sure what juju he had other than delaying the point at which the song becomes the song that we've heard too many times. And then maybe just singing it really well. Like he wasn't a strong singer when he started his career. He was like, okay, let me be a fourth-rate Frank Sinatra. Keep it in the middle. Don't try too hard because, you know, but over years of performing, like his voice became quite an instrument. You know, like it really hasn't overall changed my feelings about Oh Danny Boy. Except, you know, as an artist, just knowing that the way that we deal with these texts, you know, and the way that we deal with these themes have to be authentic enough to us. And yeah, we do have to risk people thinking, oh, they're being sappy. I was wondering if you'd talk a little bit about, Lillian Yvonne Bertram and your sort of lifelong collaboration. Maybe not lifelong, but, you know, it's been a while since you two have been sort of collaborating poetically. And, you know, it reminds me a little bit of the way a lot of rappers kind of do, you know, keep re-recording their songs and keep inviting more people to play along.
Well, I'm going to talk about Lillian, but I'm going to also mention my friend, the poet Renee Ashley. I cannot remember which of the two women it was. I'll come to Lillian in a second. But it really unfolded the same way. Late at night, I might exchange emails with Renee Ashley. She was one of the poetry editors of the Literary Review back in the, I don't know for how long she was, but she certainly was back in my Overpass days, around the time you interviewed me. But Renee and I would decide one of us would write a line and send it without any idea about, if I remember correctly, line breaks. It would just be a string of words. And then the other would send a string of words back. And at some point, one of us, Renee or I, would have to say, okay, that's a wrap. Let's look at it again in a few days and see if it's anything. I did that once or twice with Renee was all. I have kids. Renee didn't. And so at a certain point, Renee was staying up later than me. But it was Lillian was the deeper commitment. Lillian was an MFA student at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, where I was an administrator of the program. And we hit it off. I mean, I had a PhD in literature. I remember when we were recruiting her, two of the faculty poets came to me separately and said, okay, Lillian has sort of academic aspirations that might make you a good fit for a conversation as we try to make sure she comes to our school as opposed to somewhere else. We hit it off very early on, but there was no collaboration until, I don't know, it was after her first book came out. Somewhere in there, the same thing unfolded late at night, and we were becoming close when she left, but through email closer. I became a sort of joking father figure to her, although she had a father of her own. For instance, her
literary father.
Yeah, literary father. Her first book, her first collection, she came to me with all of her fears and anxieties about what the cover was going to look like. And so we had a fairly intimate literary relationship. And it unfolded the same way. One of us sent a line to the other, and the poem unfolded. Now, Lillian's far more alpha than I am, or Renee is, and Lillian's going to enjoy hearing this if she listens to the interview. But I decided it was easiest just to let her make decisions about line breaks when the poem was over. And I don't know if you've seen her latest book, Travesty Generator, but she's working with computer code and all kinds of things. For instance, when you first met her, she was doing that remake of a poem of mine, which involved some programming or coding. She's going far beyond that now, running workshops about it as she runs the MFA program at UMass Boston. We probably, either Renee and I or Lillian and I, could have done this forever, but it was very sporadically done. So I think Lillian and I did maybe two or three, Renee one or two. I was going to put the collaboration with Renee in the book, but I didn't quite know if it was good to put that collaboration in the book when I had a blurb from her on the back of the book. I didn't quite know if what the code was for, you know, collaboration. So she said, sure, take me out. So I took her out and used her blurb instead. But yeah, Lillian's an up and comer. She's smart as a whip. She finished a PhD at Utah. Right now she's struggling as everybody else is. All of y'all are who have in campus writers, but I'm happy to be connected with Lillian in any way, but she's a good peeps too. And I've read with her in Chicago, and as she was, the joke would be she's another Davin daughter, as we say. There are no Davin sons, by the way. I've got about four or five daughters of my own by, you know, real daughters. And then I've got about a half dozen Davin daughters out there. And I don't think I have any Davin sons. It just isn't as funny a title.
Well, I think also, you know, if you're a man of a certain ruggedness or individual mindedness, or you at least want to convey that, I think that having real female friends really helps to, I don't know, keep us from becoming too big of an asshole. And sometimes maybe not necessarily calling us out, but making us more aware of things so that we don't have to be called out for buying into our own hype, even though I think part of that whole masculine writer thing is about our own insecurities in the first place. Like, we know this thing is mostly made up in our own heads, and that maybe we can get other people to believe it. But that doesn't mean that we even ourselves believe it. But I have found that having the friendship of women has really kept me out of, I don't know, the gutter of, and this is like a bowling metaphor, the gutter of male thought, which just goes straight without ever going into the area of actual real play.
Well, I have three sisters, no brothers. I raised a daughter, not my biological daughter, but I raised her from ages 5 to 10. And then I have four biological daughters. You know, I've had a male roommate for like 10 weeks in my entire life. So I don't know what it's like. I know what it's like to be the man I am, but I don't know what it's like to live for extended periods with males. So I'm very comfortable, you know, around women. I'm still alive in my house of women here. They still let me live here. And they would say mama runs everything, but they still call me daddy, so I'm happy.
And so you had a stroke, which is one of the stories that appears in these different poems and informs a lot of them. And, you know, I don't think I've had a stroke, but I can relate to so much of the energy in these poems about chasing after meaning and trying to establish meaning. And I mean that in a way where these poems are a little challenging. They're not completely linguistic chaos or anything. It's not, I guess, my touchstone for as far as I'm willing to go is John Ashbery. Like, John Ashbery's good. I don't need to read a lot of him. Because if I spend serious time reading, I don't know, three John Ashbery poems, I'm good for at least 6 months. You know, like, they're good. I don't know that we need a lot of them. And in your case, you know, like, these poems, you know, they're really challenging, but I can see what they're doing. And there's so much heart in them. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about just your experience with the stroke and how you think, you know, that theme helped generate these poems.
I'll do the biographical first. Late August, 10 years ago, with four daughters and my wife at a middle school cross-country meet here in the Twin Cities of Champaign-Urbana, I was enjoying a beautiful Saturday late morning. My daughter was the oldest of my daughters, who all became athletic in one way or the other, but this was the very beginning. I was just happy to see her running. And the race was over, and a friend of hers was standing nearby who had finished. And I said something to the little girl. And she knew me, but she looked horrified. And I was struck by that. She turned to her mother, and I said something again. And they both looked nervous. I was had no idea why. I walked away. I saw my wife and my four daughters, ranging in age from probably, 12, 13, down to 4 or 5. And we're walking to our family van, and I say something to them. And they look confused and a little, they think I'm joking. I said something again, same response. We get into the van, and my wife says, I don't think you should drive. And that it's a very small neighborhood with, minivans everywhere, and it's hard to get through them. And you were talking about being over-masculine and an asshole. I don't think I usually am, but I suspect I was then because I refused to back down. I just thought, to my wife, I was thinking, you're always nervous when somebody else drives. And she was, and my daughters will attest to this. So I started driving between the cars. What I didn't know was I had no peripheral vision on my right side. And so I was probably coming very close to those cars. So my wife said, pull over. And I thought, not pulling over. And I kept driving, and I would say something, and I could tell something was wrong. My wife says, we need to get to the emergency room. So I pulled over. She grabbed the wheel. Now, understand, we didn't know I was having a stroke. I was, aside from the fact I had no language, I was suffering aphasia, but we didn't know that. It's probably 3 miles to the emergency room. We decide a half a mile into that 3 mile journey, my wife does, that we need to stop at a Walgreens because three of the little girls have to pee. So all those signs about if you're having a stroke, hurry up and get the hospital, have an asterisk, unless your little girls have to pee, no longer at a Walgreens. So we're sitting in front of Walgreens, and I'm in the van with the oldest of my daughters, and I know something's wrong at this point. Again, stroke would never have come to me. Certainly hadn't come to my wife. I turn to my oldest daughter and make some sort of gesture. I want to know one more time if I can say something she can understand. She looks very nervous and sad and shakes her head no when I make the attempt. And then we go to the hospital. And in the hospital, I failed the aphasia test where I was shown a very 1950s drawing of essentially June Cleaver at the sink with kids on ladders pulling cookie jars down and chaos. And she asked me what was going on, and I knew that I didn't know. I understood her when she said to my wife, who no one had ever called Mrs. Davenport, she said, Mrs. Davenport, your husband is in the middle of a stroke. Now, some of this my wife will say I'm reconstructing out of bits and pieces, because I remember that I asked my wife to repeat the names of our daughters, first and middle, because I didn't even know my wife's name sitting there. Now, I had no language. I could not have asked her. So there's a lot of reconstruction of what happens. But I do know that I was...
Your inside voice asked her.
I was on a gurney in a hall waiting for a machine to be fired up that would tell them whether I was suffering a bleed or not, my brain. At that point, they would know whether they're going to give me the very expensive pill to save my life or not. My mother was a registered nurse. I was used to medical language. I have a PhD in English. I'm not afraid of language. I was lying alongside this bulletin board, and I saw medical language, and I started speaking the words aloud. Again, trying to quit falling deeper into this hole of no language. So what had happened was I was coming out of it, aphasia. The nurse and doctors were shocked. I went to the hospital anyway. I got my language back right there at the bulletin board. I took tests. They sent me to Chicago for the cerebral angiogram from the poem Dear Cerebral Angiogram, where they, you get stripped naked and you're basically strapped to a long, narrow board So you cannot move any part of your body, basically. And they shoot dye from your groin up through your heart into your brain so they can read things. They tell you it might feel really good or it might feel really bad. And I'm here to report that the idea of the last line in Cerebral Angiogram where I say, flower pot, I love your crazy hair. If you remember the classic Dylan poster of his hair colored and shooting up in different directions, that's what it looked like. And it was beautiful. And then I heard them say, okay, and now the second one. And I went, oh, crap.
Wait.
Yes.
But did it feel really good or really bad?
It felt really good, the first one with the Bob Dylan hair shooting up, the flower pot, I love your crazy hair. It was warm. It was comforting. I thought, I'll do this. This is lovely. But then they said, and now we're going to do a second time. And that was cold and was uncomfortable. They learned nothing. All the tests they ran, they learned nothing. They said that maybe it was just I forget what it's called, just a little event, or it was a stroke. They never could figure it out. I know that I was told, don't do anything physical, anything strenuous, don't even, beware the Elvis. Don't sit in a toilet and get muscular, don't do anything. So I was losing weight. I was never a sad guy, but I was a lot quiet for a few months. But I had two obligations regarding writing. A friend of mine, John Griswold, was doing some podcasts for an AWP coming up. And I had promised him I would do something. And I had a friend, Susan Young, who published my second book, who had a literary magazine, poetry magazine. And she asked me if I would write the intro for her, an issue of that December. So here it is, October. I'm as depressed as I'll ever be in my life. And those two events pulled me up and out and forced me to speak about writing, to think about writing. For the podcast, I wrote song lyrics. For the Lit Mag, I wrote a very poetic and complicated intro that involved a line from each of the poems in the magazine. I mean, I put myself through, I think, some tough tests to see if I had language. And I was as good as ever, I thought. But I did not want to write another, set of poems. But Robert Stewart and all those other opportunities started to come up, and one thing led to another. But I am surprised that when you say that some of the poems and Bruce songs might be challenging, because, when I first sat down to write a long time, if you had said to me a week before I started writing poems at age 40 or 41, I would have thought, yeah, I'm going to be John Ashbery. I'm going to be a difficult modernist. I'm going to write poems you will never understand. And then I tried that, and they were shitty. They were incomprehensible. They were phony. They were bad. And so I found, through experiments with form, I could write poems that did well, and it went from there. But when I set out to write the Bruce song poems, I told myself, you're not going to write sonnets. You're not going to write in any form. You're going to open up, and these will be more prosaic. These will be less complicated. These will be, poems my mother will read and not say to me, Stephen Michael, do you have to be difficult? Do you have to be so arty? But I will admit there are a couple of poems. One of the poems I wrote to Lillian in there is about as difficult, perhaps, a poem as I've ever written, complicated. But many of them I just intended to be open and accessible. Like song, rhyme is everything in song, but just to make it simple. So I'll ask you a question.
Okay.
Name me a poem from Bruce songs that's difficult besides the one dedicated to Lily. which I made difficult, by the way, because she writes difficult poetry. So that poem to her is her fault.
I don't mean to sound like our beloved president on the Bible, but yeah, I kind of like all of them. I think it's a question of, you know, and I think this is something that Laurie Anderson does so well, which is sometimes what she writes is really, really out there. And she will find really prosaic ways of talking about it so that it makes the audience feel like, okay, no, like this isn't completely challenging. It's not all random. It's not all starting 8 zip codes away from where I want to start. You know, the thing that I love about how these poems seem to be challenging is it's simultaneously reporting about complex life experiences while also kind of experiencing those life experiences. And so that I think there's a kind of double focus. Does that make any sense at all?
Yeah, I guess I'm going to, it just occurred to me that, for instance, the first song in the book, first poem in the book is very short, but I was invited to come read somewhere in Champaign-Urbana. And I thought, okay, I've got to write a poem that will do better with an audience than some of the short poems in Overpass or an Uncontainable Noise. I'd learned enough being an administrator of an MFA, an undergraduate creative writing program, with all the readings I would go to, that audiences benefit from a poem that's long enough that they can learn while it's being read to them how to listen to it, how to interact with it. So I thought to myself, I've got to have a poem that will go on long enough. You know, and so I wrote a poem in here, and I'm not saying I should read it right now here, but I wrote, and it's a poem which at the time I did not intend at Trump, although he made the poem better early on.
I think that's the first time that claim has ever been made.
Dear Happy Ending. When I wrote Dear Happy Ending, by the time I wrote it and I went to read it, he, as I said, Trump made it better, you know? I didn't write it about him, but when I was reading it that night, I remember I said, I could just now retitle this poem, like America 2017 or 2018 or whatever it was.
Well, let's give it a rip. Let's listen to it.
You want me to read this? Okay.
Let's see if it bears out my hypothesis at all.
Okay, well, we'll see. I have to find it first. Dear Happy Ending, where are you?
Page 34.
Oh, thank you very much. Dear Happy Ending, it rained last week for 100 years and change. Bitter change, like 99 nuts for one squirrel and one nut for 99. Loose change, like the weight of bodies depends on the neighborhoods they come from. The ones they fall in. Neighborhood may not be the right word. Happy ending, forgive me. How much longer? Are we there yet? I have to pee and I want the 99 everyone wants. Last Thursday during happy hour, over cocktail wieners, pitchers of beer, and buckets of popcorn, thunder rattled like ammo bins, 3 nights straight. And it was good because it kept everyone inside while the place burned and we got what we deserved, being mostly water and self-interested. Dear Happy Ending, your friend list looks like a family reunion. You should get out more, meet people, improve the stock, give us all a chance. When I was 15, astronauts stepped down onto the moon, dividing it forever with a flag and some God. They tracked moon dust back into the cabin. It smelled, they said, like gunpowder. Of course it did, and mankind didn't mean mankind. That was the day I grew shark fins, a couple of whiskers, and a hard line of self-interrogation. Dear Happy Ending, there's a reason why empires collapse and people who restrict membership with gates and property guns get eaten by fire ants. I too want to live in a tall, round house with no windows, no moat, no drawbridge. On the roof, a water park with lights and a helicopter. It's not a lot to ask. For art, I was once half bird, half dynamo, a flapping, feathery whir of parts that stole the sun and divided it into many things, into water and glint, into chaff and spark, into salt and peter, into bang and whoosh. We are far from those days, the sun's old way of doing business, and I can't remember where some things are buried. Dear happy ending, 20 days after the moon turned to gunpowder, Manson's gang went helter-skelter on some gated folks. That was wrong in a different way, so they went to prison. Parole is harder now for some folks because there's no forgiveness. The victims' families make sure of that with their Bill of Rights. I want a new Bill of Rights and flying lessons. I want to kill bad guys one by one, go home in my helicopter to my fountain of lights, my 99 nuts. Next month, it will rain for decades. The past tense of shit will be shot. We should all be shot. I shit you not. I shoot you twice because the world happy ending is a hard place for most of us. I think you know that. I think you planned it that way.
That's a great one.
The idea, I think, when I wrote that was just to say, okay, you're not writing. Oh, by the way, I listened to that interview we did 100 years ago, and I referred to the early sonnets I wrote as having 14 syllables, and it was 12 syllables, so I don't know what I was talking about. I did not want to count. There's only one poem in this entire collection where I count syllables. I did not want to count syllables. I didn't want to confine myself to a page. The poem of mine that's done the best for me is in this collection. It's a Dear Number Two Pencil. It always gets people always point it out to me. I wanted to try more of that. You know, I wanted to try to write a poem which would have a voice that's real. It's not phony. And if you have to follow my mind through some ideas or through a forest of images, I don't want anybody to get lost. I maybe want you to want to read it a second time or a third time. So I guess some difficulty. I mean, song, there often needs to be a hook or a lyric which causes you to immediately interact in it, to play along, to sing along. That's not so in poetry, it seems to me. But I wanted people to, maybe want to return to these longer poems. Maybe need to return. Maybe that's where, you might speak difficulty. So is that an example of one of the ones you were talking about?
Not especially. I mean, yeah, there are the turns of mind that are happening and they're not always completely rational. But again, I don't think we read poems for perfect rationality.
No, I sound like I'm defending Charles Manson or something in there. One of my friends, I think that's when he first read the poem. I think that's what he thought. But I was thinking of John Edgar Wideman, the great writer who, we'll talk about forgiveness because his brother in prison, and no matter what happens, the victims, the living relatives, the person who's been killed or robbed or whatever happens, can't let go of their pain and don't want to forgive. But I also turn quickly after that and say, I want to go kill bad guys. So to follow turns of mind would be a good description of what I think can happen if a poem is longer. And that's what I was after in those poems.
Well, I think, when it comes to encouraging readers to return to your poetry and reread it, part of the challenge is making sure there are enough hooks so that we get attached to the poem, even if we don't completely understand every word or follow all the turns the first time.
Sounds like Wallace Stevens. Now, that for me is as an undergrad Wallace Stevens. I did not understand Wallace Stevens, but the music in the poetry, the sounds I can make with my mouth when reading his poems aloud, made me return. meaning came later.
And one of your poems kind of bears homage to that, doesn't it?
And that is, remember, I forget things, so which poem would that be?
Aflatus Behind Dumpsters in America.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Right.
All right. Let's have Aflatus, a go at that one.
Okay. Aflatus Behind Dumpsters in America. Again, I'm invited to read somewhere in town. It's Valentine's Day, and there's a poetry crawl about love. But we don't have to read poems about love. And I know that at this poetry reading is going to be at least one of my daughters. And I know that it's very likely some of the MFA students are going to be there. And they don't necessarily see me as a poet. They see me as the assistant principal. When I used to call them into my office, it might be talking about scheduling of classes or whatever, but half the time they'd sit down and they would say, okay, what did I do wrong? What did I do wrong? And I'd say, I've become the assistant principal. So I knew they were going to be there. Lillian Bertram by this time is long gone. I've got two books out, again, with no idea I'm going to have Bruce songs. And I had a couple of lines that I couldn't get out of my head. And I had a week and I wanted to read something long. And I knew it couldn't be Dear Happy Endings because I knew some of the people who would be there heard me read that the year before. So that poem, you know, was born. You wanted me to read this one?
Yeah, please.
We'll talk about. Okay. I'm going to support you here by saying I had no idea what this poem was going to be about as it was unfolding. I was holding on to a couple of lines, probably, and images. I knew the business of the days of the week, the Hello Friday, for some reason. I had that in the days of the week, and that's all I knew was going to happen. But it's filled with literary allusions, and you're right. This is probably what I would call like a make-out poem for English majors, maybe, because of all the references. And the idea of Aflatus being that inspirational whiff of wind or, you know, the creative spark. And I decided I was going to get political. I'd already written Dear Happy Endings with the idea. I was after separation of wealth. Wasn't thinking about Trump. I wasn't necessarily thinking about Trump when I wrote this poem, but I was dead set on being writing about something other than just me and my damage or damage to the land around me. I wanted to get a little more political. It's for a friend of mine up from some dirt, who's a great poet and illustrator, he's from Louisville, Kentucky, lives in Lexington, Kentucky. His name is Ron Davis. And Ron, if you're listening to this, as I always tell you, you are an inspiration to me, and much of your work, his illustrations, are what I first knew. I dedicated this to him after I wrote it. But it's called Aflatus Behind Dumpsters in America. I'd say hello, Friday, you sexy wolf, roller of big cigars, full belly dragging through Cuban waters and green hostilities, maker of the first beginning, which is light and breath, blowing big ships and new routes, you river of mash rolling, you 100 bottles of beer on the wall. I'd take you down, Friday, and pass you around, and you might be the emperor of ice cream they talk about, muscular accountant of concupiscence, keeper of the ledger I don't want read while I'm living, while I have children who like ice cream more than bodies. And there were bodies being bodies, and I hope I'm right about the ice cream. I'd say hello, Friday, and we'd rip the long flesh together, string couplets of sinew and blood round all the available bellies. We'd go thigh to high valley and praise song to deep hallelujah, moist hallelujah. We would, but don't tell my children, Friday, my daughters, don't tell them I'm here these days. Behind this dumpster, around the corner, waiting for change and improvement of my circumstances, and I'm not the only one. Back to the wall, crisscross applesauce in America, because Friday, these days, your ass to patchy grass, no better than Thursday, Tuesday's thick twin, kissing cousin to Monday and Wednesday, who blame each other for everything. I'd say hello, Friday, or America, what's the difference, and forgive you this dumpster, but truth's important too, which doesn't mean this isn't a poem, which doesn't mean it is either, which doesn't mean it isn't also a treatise, a dissertation on a flatus, sudden gathering, wind-blown kickstart, a disquisition on divine breath. See Holy Spirit for English majors. See original invention. See a flatus at wikipedia.org. Or maybe it's a spell, all pork pie hat and Godot tattoo and iambic inspiration, or a dream, America. I need a dream about a Friday that switches things up by tomorrow, Saturday, which is a math problem if you think Sunday's a map of soft deserts and leafy mountaintops. See life behind dumpster. Here's the thing, oh grain of sand, oh wildflower, I never once saw the world in either of you, or heaven, though I had good teachers. Oh, winds of change, what change? Wildflowers got nothing on the five kinds of stank trapped here behind this dumpster by city planners. See a flatus, see dead air. But I'll make do, Friday, and truth is it's dinner time, and this half a chicken wing ain't bad as it looks. So Friday, this here's my disquisitional poem about poetry or a flatus or dumpster life here around the corner. Some days I write in the dead air to freak a dead end, a long wait for meaning, like I learned from good teachers. But these days, America, Friday, I'm studying accessibility. I'm blowing this breath, good or bad, your way.
So I presume this was read on a Friday.
Yes, it was. I believe it was. That was probably just a luck of Valentine's Day that year. But yeah, I mean, this poem was really, and it's not the only one, but it was really written to order, you know? Yep. I would
an occasional poem.
None of the this book would never have happened if a relationship, an email relationship with a person out there who liked one of the poems in Overpass, and I found out about it, and we began to correspond, and then she was the poetry became the poetry editor for the inaugural, well, still is, but for the inaugural issue of a beautiful magazine out of California called Your Impossible Voice. And she solicited poems. And I remember I was sitting in my living room. This email came in and she said, do you have some poems for the inaugural issue of Your Impossible Voice? And I thought, what an impossibly beautiful title, Your Impossible Voice. And I've been asked, I want to be somebody's impossible voice. And she said, I would really love for you to be in there. Do you have some poems? And I said, yes. And I had nothing. And I said, I mean, I felt like a date there, right? Somebody's asking me out. I'm lying immediately about what I can do on this date.
Can you pick me up? Do you have a car? Like,
I have a car.
Of course I have a car, which means I will find a way to have a car.
I will steal a car. So I asked her when she needed the poems by, and she gave me a month or more. And so I knew I would get her something. And then I immediately turned the ball game back on that I was watching. And a month or so later, in a little quick bit, I wrote Dear Number Two Pencil. And then she said she wanted it recorded. And so I first time I ever recorded anything also, it happened all at once, but it was simply because she asked me, and that I think is when in the back of my brain somewhere, and the response that poem got, I needed someplace for that particular poem to be more visible. And probably I owe the entire collection, not, well, I owe it to my stroke, of course, but I think I owe it to a couple of people out there, a poet friend, Mark Sanders being one, but who believed in the poems. And every time I said, I'm done, I'm never writing another one, they just laughed at me and said, sure, you're never going to write another one. But I owe to your impossible voice for, like, I think the Literary Review made Overpass possible, and your impossible voice made Bruce Songs possible.
Well, I think of the comedian Doug Stanhope, who apparently has retired privately several times.
Yes.
And despite how little he wants to be shackled to his comedy career, for whatever his reasons are, and I found this with my own writing life, where I'm not getting enough writing done, and there have been times that I'm like, my life would be so easier if it just didn't care, and if I just stopped trying. And I've tried it. Like, okay, I'm not going to try. Let's just live a good life or a decent life. Let's just try and get the work you have to get done, and then maybe relax in the pool. And the brain starts twitching, and the words start coming, and it's like, oh, damn it.
Right.
So that
it is.
You're trying, you know, I've tried to give up and quit, and no, this is a lifelong thing I'm up to, no matter what success level I'm having or not having. This is part of being alive for me, is just getting the words out and then scratching my head and going, okay, did that one mean anything?
Well, you know, I listened again, that interview that Mr. Poisson did with you, and he said the thing I said to you after I read the novel, and I immediately wrote you an email, and I think somewhere in there I said, okay, when's the next guy Psycho? Where's the next one? The next one, the next one. And he mentioned it too. You know, there's so much in the back of the book to suggest another volume or two.
Well, it ends, yeah, with this sort of Mobius loop, like, okay, they just finished this adventure that really blew out the whole idea of what an adventure can do, but also suggesting, oh, and the next adventure starts now. Like this very millisecond at the end of the book. And right. Yeah, some of my readers have indicated like, okay, so that's the next book, right? I'm like, oh no, this is like five adventures after that. Like this.
Right. I remember being in grad school and hearing about a Charles Dickens, let's say, going down to the local convenience store, and he's publishing his novels in installments. Right. And he goes to the convenience store and hears somebody saying, hey, have you read this latest installment by Charles Dickens? I just can't wait for the next one. And he's just thinking, I'm just here to buy a laxative and a case of beer and go back and relax in the pool. And now I have to get back home and get the next installment done. So, yeah, I understand the pressure.
Yeah. And, you know, I wrote the book in such a way that even though I have like over 40 titles of Guy Psycho sequels, like the titles, the names of the books, yeah. Like I have them, but I just, yeah, don't have any of the plots for those.
Well, I think the next book should be just the titles. Or is that too arty?
It might be too arty. On the other hand, it might be the best I got. No, because I didn't save anything, right? I didn't hold anything back with that first book. Like, oh, and then for the second one, I'll have this on tap. And so then I'm like, no. Like, I kind of exploded all the sets at once. And, you know, I'm really, once I see a path forward, I'll be really happy. And I'm really looking for it and I'm researching it. But until I have enough momentum, like I can't. But, you know, I do feel like at the end of James Bond movies, right? That was the last line is in the credits. James Bond will return in Thunderball. It's like, okay, like it's not over. We'll still get one more.
Yeah. In 2005 or so, before my first book was published, I would say to my wife, I can't wait to stop being a poet. And she would say, well, I have news for you. You can stop right now. And I said, no, but I can't stop being a poet until this collection is published. And it was published, and I felt a tremendous sense of relief. And I thought, okay, good, I'm done. But like you said, the brain twitches, the muscle twitches. What always kills me is a line falls in, you know, to my vision, and I can't swat the line away. I try to step on the line, I can't kill it. It comes back, and then the only way to get rid of it is to build something out of it. And that keeps happening. And then I'm back where I was before. I can't wait to quit being a poet.
Hunter Thompson was frustrated that he was a journalist. And his giant journalism career, he thought was a failure because he was a failed novelist.
Right.
He did get to publish The Rum Diaries, right? He did get one novel publication before he died.
Right, but probably not nearly as appealing as just that great voice of his.
Yeah, no, and The Rum Diary, like, it's an okay book, but it's not. I think because he didn't see himself as a journalist, he could be the worst and most interesting journalist.
Right, right.
And also Rolling Stone coming into existence at exactly the right time for him kind of let all of those crazy things happen. And that's kind of the theme of The Drunken Odyssey is, well, we've got a plan. And as writers, the plans seldom go smoothly. And right, Stephen King jokes, you know, people want to know where we get our ideas from. And he's like, we don't know.
I heard Harlan long before I thought I would ever be a writer on the old Tom Snyder show, Harlan Ellison, who could be a difficult interview and a difficult man, said that people were always asking him where he got his ideas. And I'll never forget that he said he sends $25 to Schenectady. And the city of Schenectady sends him back ideas. I thought, oh, that's a good $25 seemed to be a lot of money at that time.
Is it a P.O. box? Can we get that? It's
exactly.
Well, and I do tell, you know, my younger writers or my writing students, you know, yeah, make sure you just have a notebook for your ideas so that if you're frustrated and you want to write, you got nothing. It's like, well, you probably have something in there. And the older you get, you know, like the more junk you have in there, that may be pretty special.
Yeah, I'm happy I retired from education, but I do miss those conversations with students most of all. And one of the things, and you brought it up when you talked about sort of meaning or difficulty of meaning, but always the hardest thing to do with young poets, and I'm talking about young because the University of Illinois, they don't come in all ages, and they come straight out of high school. Most of them haven't read any poetry, so they want to rhyme.
Or poetry by people who are alive.
Right. Right, exactly. They haven't read any of that. And the other is that the minute they begin to see that you know, writing tight little rhyming poems that are moralistic or whatever, the minute they start to get arty, again, without having read anything, they decide the best move is to be obscure. The best move is to shove all of your meaning under a rock or under the moon. And I have to get them to push a fair amount of that meaning out under the sun. There's the red wheelbarrow in the rain, of course. Things I could not understand as a young person that I understand much more deeply now, that there's poetry in meaning that's pushed out under the sun. You know, so that's why, you know, in Bruce songs, I try to be what I talk about in that poem, the Aflatus poem. You know, I'm studying accessibility, how to be accessible, yet need to be read twice. You know, push the meaning under the sun, but there has to be something in the music or the meaning.
You have to be the Buddha by the dumpster.
Exactly. That half a chicken wing.
Well, and I think hearing you read your poems, they seem less challenging than when I read them in my own head. Maybe it's because my own head is screaming a little bit right now. But, you know, you have dialectics in there that are clear, but a dialectic isn't something that you could just go, oh, all right, that was an easy swallow, and now I will just comfortably digest this contradiction that's totally true, which is, you believe in vengeance and forgiveness. You believe that writing a poem means also writing something that maybe isn't a poem. And that, you know, like the definition of a poem is itself elusive. And that if it isn't elusive, then maybe what you're writing isn't interesting enough or isn't out in the sun enough, or you're putting the wrong thing in the sun.
Right. Well, you know, I would tell my, I do tell or did tell my students that the better place to be poetic is in prose. The worst place to be poetic is in poetry. You know, if you're going to have a, if you're going to strive for original voice or stark image or being memorable, it is to often write sentences that anybody could write. You know, the meaning, the clarity is high. Now, if it is true that what we go, we come to some poems for is to follow somebody that turns their mind, we need to be interesting. And therefore, you and I and 10 other good writers may all push our meaning out under the sun, but it may be radically different appeals, you know, different ways of appealing to people. I've not read that much John Ashbery, I can tell you, because when I came to John Ashbery, probably in a master's program, maybe as an undergrad, there wasn't as much dependence on music, sound, as there was, let's say, in Edgar Allan Poe or Wallace Stevens or T.S. Eliot. I didn't find myself wanting to read aloud John Ashbery. But I found myself wanting to go lock my bedroom door or the bathroom door and look in the mirror and read aloud some of these other poets long before I understood them. So I think there is always a poet friend of mine, Lee Graham, one time said to me, she was working for Atticus Review and did an interview with me. And she said, she always thinks of, you know, she thinks of painting with some people's poetry or some with me, it's music. I thought, really? That hadn't occurred to me. And now I've already had my first two books out. So Blues Songs is in part a reaction to Lee bringing that up, you know?
Poetry is a lot more social than I think we generally give it credit for.
Yeah, I think again, I brought up my friend Mark Sanders, a Nebraska poet who moved down to, and lives and teaches in Texas. And he's, as I said, one of those friends who would say, no, you're not done. But he was one of the people after Dear Number Two Pencil got a hold of me and a poem. So I'm going to tell you really quick, and it'll bring me back to him, I hope. And if I forget, you can mention him. But he got a hold of me and said, you know, you're not done writing poems. And why don't you, there's an open call at Stephen F. Austin University Press. There's an open call. Why don't you send a manuscript there? And I thought, that sounds great, but I don't have a manuscript. I don't have enough poems. But that didn't stop me. I went ahead and put that overly thin manuscript together and sent it and forgot about it. And I'm sitting at a middle school volleyball match, a really important one, to us who are the parents and the kids. And I get an email, and it's from Stephen F. Austin University Press. And I'm told they love the manuscript and they want to publish it. Now, this a very important point. My daughter's probably serving. So I've got one side of my brain, I'm trying to cheer volleyball, and I get this email about poetry, and I want to stop the match and tell everybody or scream. I start immediately ignoring the email, but I can't quit thinking about how that manuscript is not ready. And I don't mean ready in terms of I'm difficult and I've got a full manuscript and it's in the wrong order. I mean, there aren't enough poems. How could they have said this was ready to go? So to make a long story short, I had to write some poems. And so I wrote one of the poems in the book that basically was because I had a title I wanted to use, and I wrote it. And I have to say, I've never asked another male to not coach me, but I've never shared my poems with males ahead of time. And I have no reason to say why. I mean, I've got a good friend, I might show him the poems, but he's no poet and he's basically just going to cheer me on. But I'd show poems to Lillian, I might show poems to Renee Ashley, but I shared this with Mark Sanders. And I don't remember if this was, I think this was after the manuscript had been accepted. And it's the poem called Third Arm of the Lord, which is for coffee, which is off a joke when I was coming into a room once with liquor in one hand, an album in another hand. And somebody else wanted the liquor. I wanted coffee. And I said, I need a third arm for coffee. And I said, I will call it the third arm of the Lord, which is for coffee. 20 years later, I need poems for this manuscript. And I think this was a poem I wrote because I needed poems. And there are three or four poems in this collection which were written because I needed them. And now they're some of my favorite because they're the most recent written. And that's usually what the case is. I like the poems I've more recently written. Do you want me to read that one? The Lord? Or do we have time?
Yeah, no, we've got plenty of time.
Okay.
So this is another case of having a deep notebook can really make all the difference for a writer.
Well, I just read an article about this idea that some people, you know, want to get rid of parts of their body, and that it's middle-aged white men primarily who have this body disorder. And so I had that content in my head, and I thought, wow. And I almost never start with an idea for a poem. It's always music. It's always the sound of a line. But in this case, I thought, okay, Dear Number Two Pencil was largely successful beyond, you know, my majesty because of this story I put in it. What story can I put in a poem that's unusual? I'd never wanted to dismember myself, but I thought this is interesting. And this involves, you know, the body and damage. But I wanted the title to be Third Arm of the Lord, which is for coffee. So I set off in this poem again to write one that would do well out loud, where all the poems in Overpass I meant to do well on the page first. Third Arm of the Lord, which is for coffee. And I dedicated it to my two closest friends from grad school that we got together after we had, you know, had our PhDs or finished our PhDs. Met in a location and talked about all wanting to be writers. It's like we confessed to each other. This is back when it all started in the mid-90s. Third Arm of the Lord, which is for coffee. Once I walked in snow at 3 a.m. and asked the land large questions about beginnings, endings, gain, and loss, about silence, when and where it falls. And if no one's there to hear it, what then? I ask the land because I believe in it. Name an animal species that has three legs. Kangaroos don't count. Amputees are not a species. Pop quizzes are good for your brain. One Saturday in the family van, I lost words. Became a sock of consonants in the ER, amputation of song on a gurney. In a hall just short of the machine that reads bleeds, I grew a syllable that became a word and a phrase, then a sentence. Nurse said miracle. Doctor said hospital. I said daughters. I said wife. I said their names, first and middle. I built a ladder. Some people seek limb removal because they don't feel whole otherwise. Addition by subtraction. The majority of these travelers are middle-aged white men. See body integrity identity disorder. See self-amputation. We are all travelers. Now is a good time to leave, to go for a walk or coffee, ask large questions, write your own poem. I don't believe in the Lord, but sometimes I have this dream of addition, that I am the Lord, that you believe me to have four limbs like you, two arms, two legs, your amputatable selves made in my image. In my dream, the one I'm having right now, silence falls like sound in a forest, and it doesn't need you to hear it. and I no longer go on 3 a.m. walks or carry pen and paper from room to room in case the walls collapse around me and I lose the ones I love. My wife, my daughters, their names, first and middle. Like animal amputees, some folks lose limbs to cancer. I read a story about a young man whose hand was caught in a bear trap and he sawed it off to save his life. He knew how to do that. If you don't, instructions are available online. You'll need good reception and a good knife and a tourniquet. Luck is also good, and nerve. In this dream I'm having, I never lose those names, and I grow a third arm for coffee or the odd poem. I grow it not because I can, but because you can't, because I'm the Lord. Now that poem, I'm convinced, I wrote after the manuscript was accepted. I could check emails to, you know, if I wanted to check to make sure, but it certainly weaves in the material from the other poems about the stroke. It allows me to use that title that I wanted to use and spend it on something. What, you know, it the title came first, the story about the amputation comes later. Connection of amputation to stroke. I'll let the English majors play with that, you know, to read it, to see what connections are there. But for me, it was a way to, again, turn the mind to work through things and how to get out of the poem successfully. And I sent it to my friend, and I was not at all convinced that the poem was worthy of print. But I sent it to my friend Mark Sanders, a great poet, great friend. And he said, no, print, keep. And I did that two or three more times, and I finally had enough for the collection. Yeah. You know, that was one of the later ones.
Well, it's a great book, and, you know, it's the kind of reading experience where you could read all the poems in a sitting if you have the right chair to sit in.
See, now you gave me another title for the right chair to sit in, which would be probably a really bad poem. It's a great title.
Unless it's the perfect poem. Yeah, it sounds like a terrible poem.
Yeah, I agree. Thank you for talking me out of it.
Well, that is the show for this week. I would like to thank Steve Davenport and my intern, Alexander Pate, who, as we speak, is en route to England. I'm not sure he's coming back, folks. Let's see, if you want to be really nice to me or do yourself a favor, get a hold of my literary adventure novel, Guy Psycho and the Ziggurat of Shame, about an alcoholic lounge singer who has to reenact the epic of Gilgamesh inside a mountain in Tennessee. It's really good. Let's see, don't forget to check out thedrunkenodyssey.com throughout the week for all kinds of great written content, including The Diary of a Sawzold Scribbler, as transcribed by Dimitri Cockney, Comics Are Trying to Break Your Heart by Drew Barth, and The Curator of Schlock by Jeff Schuster. So if you really like this podcast and would like it to keep going, please review it on iTunes or it doesn't exist anymore. Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts. Let's see. Keep wearing your fucking masks, please. If there are topics you'd like to hear me cover, new genres you'd like to hear me cover, any suggestions for the show, questions, comments, concerns, manifestos, interpretive dance, please do send those in to thedrunkenodyssey@gmail.com. All right. The bar is open. I gotta go. Until next week, gang, put your ass in the chair, keep attacking those keys, and don't swallow the worm.
Never mind, John. Pass me the bottle.
Thank you for listening to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life. This is your announcer, Lauren Butler.